and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm AD Packham, and we can spot an obvious penalty without having to refer it in association with Flowers Unlimited. Well then, another Saturday and another frustrating afternoon as we failed to beat a doomed Leicester side who hadn't even scored for seven games, let alone get a point. It was very much a case of, Dr. Brighton, we'll see you now. But we didn't lose, and now we have to dust ourselves down and get on with it. And with the hopes of European qualification still very much alive, we head to Brentford on Saturday with the hope of pushing back up the league. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wears, and we are delighted to introduce you to yet another Raw Virgin. That's two in 2 weeks. It's amazing, isn't it? He's an Albion fan, of course, and he's also the author of a brand new Albion-related book called Embers. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome David Atherall. Klaxon, 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 applause, applause, applause. Hello, David. Thank you for coming on.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome.
Can I just say, AD, I can put sound effects in if you really feel like it, or should we just go with klaxon, klaxon, klaxon?
Yeah, I like klaxon, klaxon, klaxon.
All right, okay.
It sounds like klaxon. But,
no, it's the worst set of solicitors I've ever known.
Yeah, it's terrible. But, well, we're going to come and talk to you about your Albion supporting history and, of course, your book a little bit later on, David. But first, Al, we've got a little bit of housekeeping. Last Saturday, myself and Alan decamped from, as most of you know, we record the show on Zoom these days, but there was a time way back in the annals of time where we used to go into the studio and we were live every single week. And that's exactly what we were last Saturday. And we welcome Fatboy Slim to the studio.
What a nice chap.
This was part of the annual Radio Reverb fundraiser, the Reverbathon. And it went all right, Al, didn't it?
Well, we have fun. Getting to Brighton Open Market for 10 o'clock in the morning from our respective decamped bases in Worthing and Goring by Sea, respectively. thankfully, it was a nice day. And actually, the Open Market is slowly becoming the place that I'd hoped it would be.
You mean the Lindy Hoppers have sold off?
The Lindy Hoppers, thankfully, weren't there. Well, they've actually put things like market stalls up now in the middle of the area, which, as
well,
an open
market
you think,
stalls. Who knew?
Well, exactly. But yeah, with plenty of sort of very Brighton type things all around. No, I do kind of miss. I mean, there is the convenience of us recording this show here in our respective quote offices, and as Fatboy Slim pointed out, there are one or two shows on Reverb where you can tell you're not in the studio. I really hope he isn't referring to us. Let's put it this way, the likelihood of him having listened to us before is probably slim to none, so therefore he wouldn't be able to comment. I actually love the open market, and I think doing that show on Saturday really gave me the buzz for wanting to do some more live stuff because well, nothing concentrates the mind like doing a live show, and it is fun, and there's some great people down at the open market. Anyway, so we did our slot 10 till 11, sandwiched in between Melita Dennett, who's a director of Radio Reverb, also works on BBC local radio for BBC Sussex and Surrey, another fine fellow of this parish, Goatee Phil Jones, season ticket holder, husband of Mama Cherry. He had his Rocks Rich Tapestry, and their theme was lovely. It was because actually today, as we're recording this, 15th of April, it's their 25th wedding anniversary. So many congratulations to them. Really, really proud and pleased to know them. So raising a glass to them. So they had a theme for that. That's absolutely brilliant. But yes, we had some very kind, generous donations from many of the people who listen to this show and supporters of this show. But that's not to say that that's enough. We could always.
This is where you come in.
This is where you come in. So, I mean, the other thing about it is, and I think Melita made a very good point, is that if you are or have benefited from our largesse, and not say just us, just anyone on Reverb, you know, if you've had a gig that you've promoted, if you've had a charity that you've promoted, if you've raised awareness on something, Reverb has always been happy to offer that platform to you. as part of the community. Similarly, any football related stuff, we're happy to have raised awareness for men's mental health, for, like I say, for colour blindness, for a whole host of things. We've been happy to raise that platform or to offer that platform and raise awareness. And if anyone has actually benefited from that, then you know, could you possibly stop to consider maybe giving us a couple of quid back? Because if nothing else, it helps keep us going, and we're therefore happy to offer that same platform in the future. So if you are, please go to radioreverb.com, and on the main page, scroll down. There's a nice big square donate button there. And please offer whatever you can to keep this brilliant community asset going. We really enjoy being on there. We enjoy the platform that Reverb themselves offer us. Over these past 18 years, we've been able to say what we like, play what we like, without swearing, of course. Remember that time when you played a song, AD, and realized you had to take off after 12 seconds because
Yes,
some
I
rude
also
words
remember
coming
the
up, weren't
time that
there?
I played Sepultura at lunchtime on a community radio station in Brighton, and it's great.
Yeah, well, you played some of it.
No, that was a Levellers, the song you're talking about.
And before they realized they were about to indulge in some fairly ancient Anglo-Saxon vernacular.
Not that ancient, but
Not quite. So sometimes we've had to be a little bit careful. We've had several studios over the years. There's the Brighton Open Market. Before that, we were at the Ironworks, which incidentally was featured in a recent episode of Grace. And you know, we've been in North Street, we've been at the Old Steen, we've been, well, in our respective bedrooms since COVID. But no, we love doing what we're doing. We're 18 years young, and Radio Reverb, same age, because the Albion Raw is a co-founder member of the station. So if you feel like helping keeping us going, so just head to radioreverb.com and hit the donate button.
But anyway, like I said at the top of the show, we are delighted to welcome David Athol to the show, and he is a raw virgin, as well as an author of a very, very good book that has just been released. But in time of the discussion, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and your Albion supporting history?
Well, I remember my first game was my 10th birthday treat back in 1990. So Brighton versus Bradford City that was, and I remember Dean Wilkins scoring a couple of goals at that time. And then I guess through the middle of the 90s, when I had my money to spend from my paper round, that's when I started going regularly to Brighton, kind of around 94, 95. And that was the point where it very quickly started to look pretty bleak for Brighton.
Whereabouts are you from, David?
So I'm from Brighton. I grew up on the Knoll Estate.
Okay,
So
yep.
I was just to walk down the old Shoreham Road to the Goldstone. And so I did my paper round around Hope Park on a Saturday morning, and then cycled down to the games after that. So mid-90s was kind of the first years really of me going
Did you
regularly.
do the Sunday rounds as well? I used to do the Sunday rounds.
Monday to Saturday, yeah, didn't do the Sunday rounds. I think they were
Oh
much
God,
heavier
that
bags, weren't they?
I mean, obviously you can tell I've had a tough paper round. I mean, that was
Hang on, which ones did you respect? Because I did a paper round as well. Which ones did you deliver? Let's go with
so
you, David, first.
I was delivering the Evening Argus, so yeah, every day reading the Albion News as I cycled round, and well, I was very excited. Dean Wilkins was on one of the roads I used to deliver to, so that was always exciting. If I got a glimpse of him,
Brilliant.
that was an occasional treat.
Got you. So, like, what did you deliver, AD?
All the very well, I used to do it 7 days a week when I was a kid. But I mean, but the Sunday rounds were always tough because you had all of the massive supplements. So
Yeah.
basically, it was like the Grawny ad would weigh about 4 ton, and we had to do about 40 of them. So it was like I said, it was hard work.
So you both did it for a specific news agent, did you? That just give their
Mine was
local.
news agent, yeah.
And yeah, I personally only did mine. I must be bone idle in comparison, but I still reckon I probably did a little more papers than you. I did the Brighton and Hove Leader, but that was every single household within. It doesn't sound that much, but within about six streets, it's about 300 houses. And yes, you had to carry the whole lot in one go. So the hardest bit was the start bit, and the easiest bit was near the end because you had no papers left.
But 1990, that was a good year to start. The team wasn't too bad, and actually just a year away from our second, well, technically third trip to Wembley, in the playoff. Did you playoff on? Did you make it to Wembley in 91?
No, I didn't make it in 91. I think, yeah, the early 90s was a very occasional game, and it was probably around 94, 95 when I, yeah, once I had some money to spend, that I started going regularly. I remember watching the playoff games on TV and seeing those, but yeah, didn't get to go to Wembley. Didn't start going until we started not being so good, essentially.
So what's your background? You said you went as a 10th birthday trip. Was it your dad took you, and it's the kind of the orange box on? Actually, I'm not even sure if the East Stand would have been open, but do you come from an Albion supporting
1990 was
family?
open.
Yeah, so yeah, no one in my family was really into football. So I think kind of 1989, kids at school were collecting stickers,
Yes.
and I guess that was a route in. And suddenly, I guess I became football obsessed from that point. And so yeah, there wasn't any Brighton sporting history. My dad took me because he knew it was what I loved most.
Yeah.
And so went to very occasional games, kind of in the early 90s, and then with friends. From that point on, once I'd got a bit of money to spend.
And so the day itself, one, did you know you were going? But two, was there kind of a buzz to it? Because I guess probably about 1990, the crowds were not the same as our 81st games, where, it sort of went over 20,000 every time. But do you still feel that buzz? Did you have that heart flutter of seeing the pitch for the first time and a possibly slightly dilapidated stadium? But I mean, what were your feelings when you approached the ground and then went in the ground?
Yeah, it definitely was very special that first time. And having never gone to a football game before then, just walking out, and there's that kind of jaw-dropping moment when you walk up the steps. My dad took
Green
me into the
Bays.
north stand. I don't think he really realised which stand was the best one to go into. So that I think that really made it an occasion as well, because that was the boisterousness and the excitement of that beautiful sunny day. So yeah, it was a very, very special and exciting thing. And even though it probably was pretty dilapidated at that stage, it was the best that I had seen.
Of
So
course, yeah.
It's always sunny in the past. Did you not know this?
Yeah, it never rained in
But
Dalston, did it?
yes, I mean, so growing up, so you had obviously that team in 1990. But I mean, we often say on this show that your formative years, the times when you first start going with your mates, that's when you start really building that attachment, for want of a better phrase.
And
And
it's your
it
first love, isn't it?
yeah, and yeah, quite often unrequited. And
Yes.
But I mean, who were your favourite players at that point? Because I mean, not normally 13, 14, 15, that's where you really think, right, that guy, that player, he's my guy.
Yeah, I think probably the player I was most felt most attached to was Stuart Storer. I think just yeah, him running towards the North Stand was always an exciting thing. My five-a-side football team that I still play in, they're called Storer's Explorers, so
Brilliant.
named after
Yes.
Stuart Storer, and he sent us a little video of encouragement, which was a special moment for the team. So I think Stuart Storer was probably the first player that was like, oh, this is the player I love. And he took a little while to get going with Brighton. I think a couple of injuries at the beginning, and didn't quite look like he was up to it to start with. But once he got going and was playing regularly, he was very exciting. So yes, I think Stuart Storer is the one that stands out for me.
Those five-a-side leagues are great. There's some brilliant names in there. I mean, basically, I used to play up in a five-a-side league up at Stanley Deeson,
Yep, same place, yeah.
I mean, my team's called Banjo Cow's Arse, which is very appropriate. But we used to have to play against Dynamo Bakelite and Real Madras and such like. It was great, absolutely brilliant. I
Yeah,
mean,
there's still plenty of names like that.
it's as bad as making quiz teams' names up. And if I ever do run another quiz night, and they say use quiz team Aguilera or quiz Akabusi, I am actually going to suspend them or ban them just on principle, just for the lack of imagination. Having
Okay.
said that, you're quite right about five-a-side names. Some of them are genius.
Absolutely. Okay, well, when we get on to talk to you about the book, obviously we're going to do a deep dive into your inspiration to find that. But obviously we have to talk about last Saturday, and Leicester City were the visitors to the Amex. They hadn't scored for 7 games, Al.
So,
The last time they did score was, well, the last time they got a point was against us, after we were 2-0 up and capitulated. Not quite as bad this time, but a performance that actually, having watched the highlights again today,
We battered
we
them in the first
created.
half.
I mean, hang on, I've got the stats here actually. I mean, it was 21 shots, 14 off target. I mean, that tells the story of the game, if
I think
anything, don't it?
the closer to the goal we got, the more likely it was to be off target.
Yeah, XG of plus four, David.
Yeah, it was a case of so many missed opportunities, wasn't it? And as the game went on, it felt more and more like we were gonna pay for that. And Leicester, they didn't really look dangerous until the last 15 minutes, but suddenly it looked like they were more likely to win at the end. But yeah, there
We
were parts where.
gave them hope. That's the problem. I mean, they've been absolutely hopeless, and certain in certain media outlets, they've actually said, "Well, actually, all right, Southampton are already relegated, but actually, Leicester are a worse side." And
No, I can't
well,
see that.
they've had a number on us this season a little bit, I think.
David?
Yeah, they've both games we've well we threw away a 2-0 lead, didn't we, at their place, and it felt the first half felt like we should have been 2-3-3 up, but just yeah, every chance that came our way we missed. The only time we could score was from a penalty. And yeah, it was just frustrating. You think, oh, if Matoma was there, would he have just had a field day down the wing? But I don't know. We've been there before and not quite taken the chances
Yeah.
when he's been there as well. So yeah, very
Okay.
frustrating.
Well, two key points with the team here, Al, were that Carlos Baleba was starting as a centre half, and also it was a second consecutive start for Matt O'Riley. Now, where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Baleba or O'Riley here?
Well, I think that the two actually are kind of linked here, in as much as O'Riley probably wouldn't have started if Van Hekke hadn't got sent off. So, because Baleba would have got his midfield
I
berth, and
know what I'm
O'Riley
not
would have been.
convinced because I mean we didn't because we had Fatboy Slim on the show last week that gave us the opportunity to not talk about the Crystal Palace match,
No,
but
O'Riley was. O'Riley was good in that game,
O'Riley
yeah.
was my man of the match at Palace, and I was disappointed that he only got 70 minutes, and he was my man of the match on Saturday. I thought he was magnificent.
I think there's when they talk about, oh, he only had 70 minutes, I've got the it's possible that they, because he hasn't played all that much, that he's actually, would you believe, still being brought back into that level of intensity, and that word is often used by Hertzler. And to get 90 minutes out of any given player, he rarely keeps Belabor on, unless he absolutely has to, like he did against Leicester because of the position he was playing in. But the midfield, it's like he has two midfields ready to go, because he has to, because and O'Riley has not that had that relatively many minutes. So to for him to be brought off after 70 minutes, whilst it's frustrating because he's had such a good game, you don't want to risk him being then, completely knackered for the rest of the season on account of the fact that he's not 90 minutes fit. He's about 70, 75 minutes fit. So anyway, the two things together. All I would say is that Belabor is that good that he slotted in at centre back and made it look easy. Made it look easy by the fact that Leicester were hopeless for the most part. But obviously, him playing there is a waste of his talent. And if Van Hekke had been playing, that meant Belabor would have been in central midfield. Does it mean to say that things would have been better? Not necessarily, on account of the fact that the chances that we missed were A, the forward line, and B, easy. And you can set someone up and lay it on a plate and gift wrap it and hand it to them. And if they're still going to stick it in row Z, there is nothing you can do about it as a supplier, as an assist.
But I mean, David, at Crystal Palace the week before, Matt O'Riley started in that game as well. Belabor started in midfield as well. But he was kind of playing in that number 10 role that's been vacated after Jorginho being injured. But he was he makes things happen. I mean, he looks like a twig. I mean, I'm you see his legs, and it's like it is a packet of twiglets running around the football pitch, but which is quite worrying. But he sticks those long legs out, and he gets them into places, and he just makes things happen. He
Have you
was
got a question here?
well. No, I'll get to the point in a minute. But at Celtic, he was Very highly rated. Yes, I know it's Celtic, it's Scotland, and it's not the same intensity, but he had been playing in the Champions League. But moving forwards now, would you start him now? I would.
I think, yeah, without Jorginho, you need someone who's going to play in behind the striker, and it doesn't seem to work brilliantly with Pedro and Welbeck sharing that. I think both of them are better as a number nine rather than sitting behind. So O'Reilly or Gruder are probably the two options to do that. I quite liked Gruder when he's played recently. I think he is an option there. But yeah, I mean, when O'Reilly was at Celtic, he scored a lot of goals, and Hörsler, there was a lot of talk when he came about how he turned midfielders into real goal scorers, and a lot of goals came from central midfield, which hasn't really happened this season. There hasn't been many goals coming from central midfield. So, and that's what I think we hoped O'Reilly was going to be. He's going to be a goal scoring central midfielder, but injuries have made it very stop start. So I think it's probably him or Gruder to start as the number 10. I don't think central midfield is his best position.
But what we've seen from him, particularly, I mean, if you look at the goal he scored against Man City, the winning goal against Man City, it was him arriving late in the box and taking the chance. And he had similar chances twice in this game of arriving late in the box. And I'm just really excited about what's to come because we had a lot of new players come in the summer. Not all of them have bedded in immediately. But we're starting to see like the fruits of some of that now.
Yeah, I think, I mean, he hit the post, didn't he, in the first half, and
That's
so
right,
came
yeah.
very, very close to scoring. So, yeah, it's you get to this point in the season, and you half start looking ahead and thinking, what's it going to look like next season? Who has come good, and who's going to look good, and is he one of those? I don't know if he starts when everyone's fit, but yeah, I think we hope that he becomes the goal scoring midfielder that we wanted him to be.
Well, it's up to these players to make themselves undroppable, Al.
Yes, and if you're going to miss sitters, then Hörsler's going to look at that.
Yeah, I don't think he did miss any sitters.
Yes,
Well,
he did. It was a header.
the header
That
was a
header was
sitter.
shocking.
The one where he hit the post, yeah, that was all his own work, and it was like
Yeah,
it was the
but
only place he could
I'm
put
looking
it.
at. Yeah, but my point is, he still didn't score. In fact, the point you raised just now, the pair of you raised just now, the lack of goals from central midfield is a big problem. Whereas, let's go back 2 years, we had so much input from McAllister and Caicedo. I'm not so much in terms of goals, but certainly assists. And you could actually then throw in, all right, it stopped very suddenly, but Mwepu was actually getting on to do that. And this
Pascal
time, around,
Gross.
and Gross, of course, how could I forget Gross? And so you've got that. And now it's dried up. You're relying on what is a fairly mobile front line. And whether it's Welbeck, whether it's Pedro, if you're talking a Dinger, if you're talking Minté, if you're talking maybe Solly March coming on, Gruder, I think, is an attacking option. You see all these players in any combination, and I do think that any of these combinations work. And I don't fully agree with Pedro and Welbeck being a problem together. I think they actually work very well together. Although I think that sometimes there is a little bit of a sort of kind of body language problem, but any one of those forward players, you can have all the talent in the world, but if you're going to miss sitters like we did against Leicester, there is no, I'll say I'm going to say again, there's nothing you can do about it. On another day, let's rewind 2 years ago when we played Wolves. Absolutely everything that we did went in, and let's face it, in the first 20 minutes, Leicester kept giving the ball to us, giving us every chance. Wolves did that 2 years ago, and we stuck them away. This time round, we didn't. It is a kind of a little bit of an anomaly. I take your point about the last time Leicester got a point or scored a goal was against us, and here we are obliging them once again. But that's down to us. That wasn't down to Leicester having, you said, have our number. No, they didn't. We just didn't have their number. Because up front, we were hopeless.
Well, during the international break, I saw a weird thing. I saw a weird thing. I know it exists, David. I know it exists. Yankuba Minteh has another foot. He can hit the ball with his right foot. I've seen it. He scored a goal for the Gambia. Unfortunately, that foot has gone missing, and my God, that was a sitter.
That was probably the best chance, wasn't it? When he at the back post, and he just seemed to, didn't know quite how he managed to do that. That was poor. I mean, I feel very optimistic, I think, about Minter. I feel like he has got better as the season's gone on, and so I do feel that he will improve and he will become more and more important for us.
Yeah.
I think more so than Adingra.
I think you have to remember that he's still very, very young, and there is a lot of room for improvement, but my God, is he infuriating.
Didn't we say that about Trossard once upon a time? And no matter how the fact that he left us and therefore gets booed roundly, quite rightly, that was a decent player who was World Cup standard. And on their day, they could be absolutely brilliant. And I always go back to the fact that every time we make that argument about Minté doesn't have a right foot, the first assist of the season was him crossing for Mitoma to score against Everton with his right foot. And he did it brilliantly. And also that miss, as much as I think someone said earlier about would Mitoma being there have had a difference? Mitoma's been guilty of that kind of miss as well. Whereas him, it's the right foot and he'll put it the wrong side of the post from about 6 inches out. We can actually sit here and scratch our rare bottoms all day long, work out why hasn't the ball gone into the net? And the answer is there is no rhyme or reason. And if we were to play Leicester again this week, I'd be confident of sticking five past them because they will learn that they know that they let themselves down with a result that should have gone our way. And like you say, we can't say we were bad because we just about beat them in every single aspect of it except the single most important one.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, let's. I mean, I could. I've got a list of notes here. A ding remiss. A ding remiss. A ding remiss. It's like
Was he
sounds like
that
some.
bad? I only recall one,
Oh
but
my God.
then again, yeah. They all took it in turns, didn't
I
they?
think seven really gilt-edged
What, from
chances he
him?
has from Madingri. Yeah,
Blimey. I mean, I
it
remember the
was
Pedro
quite.
one that he shanked wide. I remember the powder puff shot that one of them had. It's that to be honest, they shared it around. They shared their guilt around quite handsomely.
Okay, well let's talk about because we love talking about officials on this show. It's our favourite thing. No, it's not.
No, it's not.
But I was struggling to understand how both of those penalty decisions weren't actually given in real time because I mean I can't see how you can avoid that.
David, where in the ground do you sit, and what was your take on the first one?
So I'm in the Upper West. So for, I mean, for the first one, I'm kind of in line with that, with the goal in front of the south stand.
Yeah.
And in real time, as the shot went in, I didn't spot the handball. You're kind of looking through a crowded penalty box. So in terms of that one, I didn't spot it straight off. The second one was just looked so blatant.
It was WrestleMania.
I mean, he looked like he was swung round by his shirt and chucked on the ground, and so it seemed incredible that nothing had been given for that at first.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got to be honest with you. I mean, when the first one came, well, the first one, for those who saw it as a handball, then fair enough. I can't say that the entire stadium went up. All the players did, clearly. But I don't recall a massive handball from around the stadium. I think the shot came in, it was very hard. I couldn't tell you who it was off the top of my head.
A dingrat.
Well, yeah, but it was on target. Hurrah, hurrah, it was on target. Saved brilliantly by the person who wasn't a goalkeeper.
On a
Then
Cody.
you see the replay, and it's clear he sticks his arm out, or rather, arm goes towards the ball. You can't say it's part of his natural shadow. To be fair, like, I think I'm with David here. I didn't see it firsthand. Charlie, who I've sat next to watching football for the last 40 years, I do apologise, Chaz. He saw it straight away and was incredulous. And then it's not even the fact that the referee didn't spot it. There was another 75 seconds before he blows the whistle. And no, the ball doesn't have to go out of play because you could end up playing for another 5 minutes. So yes, the VAR, which did its job, by the way.
Stuart Atwell.
Good grief. But it did its job, is the correct thing. He felt that there was enough for the referee to go and see. Did you see it live first in the stadium at the time?
I did. As you well know, Al,
You're a
sit
bit
next
further
to a
away
certain
from
Mr.
that end, yeah.
I sit next to a certain Mr. Bass, who is very eagle-eyed in these sort of things. And yeah, I mean, basically, you can see. I mean, it was like a squash shot or a tennis shot. He backed it away with his arm. It was clear as day from what I could see. And the fact that it took that long.
Did you see? Did you felt that it was that he'd actually moved his hand, or do you felt it hit his hand at that time?
No, it didn't hit his hand. He moved his arm.
No, and you saw that.
Well, you could see the movement of leaning
over. Did you
over.
See that? I'm not talking about the replay. I'm talking about live in the stadium at that time. The actual live thing.
Well, I called handball.
Yeah, I think a lot of people call handball when it hits their face. So yeah.
But I mean, it was. I don't know what the handball rule is most of the time these days, because it's like it changes from match to match and from official to official. But this one was clear. It was clear as day. Of course it was.
And correctly got the thing. And David Pedro take a good penalty.
Yeah, incredible. It's it was a few seasons ago, wasn't it, when we seemed to be. We just didn't have a penalty taker that was consistent, and we seem to be missing so many penalties. So having him being so reliable is massive and worth a few points every season. So,
I mean,
yeah,
whisper
it's great to have
him. I
think
it's something like we've missed one in about 21, something like that. I'm talking about
one.
Going back to McAllister here.
Yeah, I mean, Pedro did miss one.
But he actually then nodded in the rebound. So, yes,
rebound.
I know that. I don't know
McAllister
that counts as a
missed one at Wolves.
Yes. Yeah, one or two since McAllister took over penalty taking duties, and that's what, good 3 years ago.
Yeah, well,
pretty. I know the point. I mean, this is the point I'm making with that Davis just said is very impressive. I mean, you can't assume that once we get a penalty, we'll get a goal. Well, there's a good chance we will, but with Pedro's taking it, and obviously we'll talk about the second one. Well, let's talk about the second one now. Do you like wrestling, David?
Yeah, big fan of wrestling back in the day.
Yeah, Big Daddy and all Giant Haystacks. Yeah. Was that before your time?
It's like, I think I was more the American Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan and that kind of stuff.
And what a stand-up chap he turned out to be.
that was a nice bit of shirt swapping attempted in the penalty area in the second half, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean it seemed incredible that he tried to do that, because with VAR there's just no chance you're gonna get away with it. So why would you grab someone's shirt and chuck them on the floor when, if you just challenge them properly, you might avoid a goal. But
the refs didn't give it real time.
No, that was really odd.
And more to the point, nor did the linesman, who probably had a better view still.
It's almost as if like they're scared to make the big decisions, some of these refs.
Yeah,
it's
but the point is, Zaidi, if he does give the penalty, VAR is still going to look at it. Because they will. I mean, whether he does or doesn't give a thing. So I'd have actually thought that it's safer for the referee to give the decision. If they're really, really not sure, give the decision and be prepared to have it overturned. Unless their egos can't cope with that.
Well, the thing is, the way that it's meant to work is like if the referee gives it, they won't overturn it unless it's a clear and obvious mistake.
Likewise, if he doesn't give it, send him to the screen unless there's a clear and obvious mistake. So it's the same either way. I mean, David, which way round do you go? I've said this without sort of probably giving it too much thought, and maybe there's a big hole in my argument. Which way do you think the referee should go?
Well, I think they need to give what they think is the right decision. I think probably we're in a time now where referees can be a bit reliant upon VAR and not make big decisions and just wait and see. And I don't know if that was what was happening, but it kind of felt a bit like that, particularly with the second one. So they're able to use VAR as a safety net for not having to make a big call.
It's not meant to be a safety net, is it? I mean, referees, in my view, should referee the game as if there is no VAR, as they would do on a Sunday league game, as they would do in the Championship, as they would do League One, Two, National League North and South. It's basically obviously at the top level they have got that safety net to a certain degree, but they need to use their own mind. I mean, it was so nice having in the League Cup this year, and I think in the early rounds of the FA Cup we didn't have that far, and they were actually able to give their own decisions. And obviously, there's going to be some right decisions. There's going to be some wrong decisions. But I'd rather them not think that something they're making slightly parts going to back them up if they make a mistake.
But you know full well that particular instance for the second penalty is the very reason VAR was brought in, because the referee
I think
dropped.
without VAR, he gives that. I think he gives it.
You reckon? Well, at the very least, the linesman should have interfered.
Yeah.
Because, like I say, he was the one. Maybe the referee had an impeded view. I can't say. I haven't looked at the stills. But I could tell you that because of where the action took place there, the linesman on the far side, in other words, in the east stand, had an unimpeded view. And he could see the shirt being pulled. I just want to actually raise something quickly about something that had happened about 90 seconds earlier. I want to say it was O'Reilly that was through.
And he had his shirt pulled. It didn't go
and
down.
He had his
and he
shirt
got shot
pulled.
Away.
Now, then, there is an argument to say that should have been a penalty. Now,
yes.
If he'd have done the sort of like mildly dishonest thing, because the shirt pull wasn't enough to pull him back, but if he had actually gone backwards and gone onto the ground, yes, the referee would have given it. Clearly, if he hadn't,
and it would have
VAR
been a red
would.
card.
Yeah, and VAR would. But my point is, because he got his shot away, and I don't think he was impeded enough, you can't have double jeopardy of getting a shot away, having been told to play on, and have a penalty. It doesn't work. There was a famous incident in Southampton against Brighton a couple of years ago. Southampton, there was a foul on a Southampton player. He went through, had a shot, and the referee gave a free kick after that. And you think, no, you can't do that. That's against the laws of the game. So it couldn't go one way or the other. So, but the other one, there wasn't a chance for the player to get the ball because he got thrown to the ground and it was, you know, clear as day. Yes, I think you're right. I mean, I went back to the Mason Holgate against Matoma thing for Sheffield United against Brighton. The referee gives a yellow card, knowing full well that he can be backed up later just in case. Whereas if there's no VAR, you know, he's got skiddy underpants thinking, oh, my God, did I really think, you know, see
well,
what I thought I
we're,
saw?
We're going to talk about life without VAR very shortly. But, okay, look, before we move on, we have to talk about particularly the first Leicester equaliser, which was a howler from Lewis Dunk. Still had opportunity to put it right. And then it was a howler from Bart. But I mean, it's a great finish. I mean, Mavavidi was a pain in the backside all afternoon. There was a massive thorn in our side, wasn't he, David?
Yeah, I think him and El Canoes were both looking. We were struggling to handle both of those. They seemed to beat our defenders on repeat. And yeah, a mistake from Dunk in the centre, and we never really recovered. And then yeah, Bart should have saved it at the near post. It felt like one he should have had covered. So it was a frustrating one when we felt totally on top at that point.
I know that you have a massive downer on Bart. I mean, and I hear it every single week, whether he concedes or not. I'm going to say no, that the shot for the goal did actually deflect very slightly off Lewis Dunk, and actually I think put him off slightly.
Don't get me wrong. I don't think you're right here, Al. I haven't got a massive downer on Bart.
You moan about him every single week.
I just basically he's just getting a free ride. He is absolutely open to any sort of criticism that we feel that he deserves, because like Jason Steele gets absolutely, if Jason Steele had made the same sort of mistake, he would have been hung, drawn and quartered.
But my point is wrongly, because there was a deflection on the shot
and
Bart's trying to get himself back into position.
I saw it as a mistake. Just watched it again now. I'm still seeing it as a mistake. He was in the wrong position. And okay, yes, Lewis was possibly slightly in his.
Well, no, it did deflect off Lewis.
In his eye line, but it was, you know, he could have stopped that quite easily, I think. But
no.
If he was in the right position, it was hit too hard for him to get in position.
You know,
We agree to disagree, but I'm not.
But the point is nothing to do with whether Jason Steele would have got pelters. It's a case of actually, if you're going to judge each case, why would Jason Steele get more pelters than Bart Verbruggen?
I'm just saying you judge
each keeper on the moment rather than any prejudged concerns you have about a player.
I admit I'm yet to be completely convinced by him.
Well, again, you're back, but then you've just sort of allowed for Minte to say, well, he is young and he'll improve. But Verbruggen, as a goalkeeper, is still young. He still has, you know, as an international goalkeeper at 23, is actually very, very young. And you have that you have that level of experience, and you are allowed to suffer for it at your peril.
Well, like if you make a mistake as a goalkeeper, it's amplified, isn't it? Whereas if you make a mistake as an outfield player, you can make several mistakes during the game. But it's I'll let you settle this argument.
Yeah, I mean, he is. I mean, he's a young goalkeeper and does show, a lot of promise. I think there have been. It's hard, isn't it? I think we've brought a goalkeeper in who's very good with his feet because that's how we want to play. And shot stopping is good, but probably not excellent. And so there are some goals that he lets in that other goalkeepers might save is kind of where I'm at with him. So
Yeah.
I feel like he's good, but not excellent.
Well, this is it. And I say, I mean, if we had a better goalkeeper at the club at the moment, he'd be playing. So, and for all this stuff about, oh, that Cole Rushworth's next. Well, if he was better, then he'd be playing. Simple as that.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. It's nice to see that Jason Steele got a run out for the 21s this week. So,
Yeah, and they lost. So, yeah, let's not ever play him
yeah.
again.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. But what I am going to ask a question: is there an argument that we only had one first-choice defender on the pitch at start of the game on Saturday, and that was Pervez Estupiñan?
Lewis Dunk is the first choice on account of the fact he's the captain. Whether he should
Whether
be
you're the captain or not, there
number,
shouldn't
whether he
necessarily
should be
make
or
your
not
first
is another
choice.
matter. So if
Yeah.
you're saying was there one, I'm going to say it's up for debate because you can't actually strictly say yes or no. That
I'm
said, I
making it.
think most people would say,
Yeah.
certainly over those previous six games where we won on the bounce, that Webster and Van Hecke did very, very well.
Yeah.
I still think it's actually unfair to say that just because they're not playing and Lewis Dunk is and we're not getting the results, it's down to Lewis Dunk. It doesn't work that way
No.
because we should have thrashed Leicester and that's not down to Lewis Dunk alone.
No, it's not at all. Actually, he made some really good blocks in that game as well. But
Absolutely.
it's like, but he is. Do you think? I think hopefully he'll get fully match fit at some point and
He
get
has
back
plenty to
into some
offer
sort of
still.
form that makes him first choice again.
He has plenty to offer still, and he's very, very close to becoming the second most prolific Albion player ever. He's got a long way to go to be the most, but he's within shouting distance of Norman Gould. So
Good stuff.
he's not
Okay,
going to
well,
do it
you're
this
listening to.
season. Sorry, he's not going to do it this season.
Okay, well, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is brought to you in association with Flowers Unlimited. Where can you get some flowers, Alan?
Well, spring is sprung, the grass is riz, and I wonder where Dimboides is. You can get flowers anywhere. You can get them in our garden, actually. Our gardens are looking wonderful. But if you really want to buy some that have already been grown, head to Flowers Unlimited, 175 to 177 Portland Road, Hove. Not that far from where David grew up. All your floral needs for something that says, well done, thank you, commiserations, sincerest condolences, happy birthday, happy anniversary, or I'm sorry I smashed your windows. Your floral tributes you can get from Flowers Unlimited. David Costa, thank you very much indeed for sponsoring the Albion Roar. Head over there or go online, www.flowersunlimitedbrighton.co.uk. And if you're an Albion season ticket holder, don't forget, you get 20% off their retail price. Go there.
Broken windows sounds very like much like me practicing for my five-a-side team, actually. But
How many,
that
actually,
was
that's the
good.
point, David. How many windows have you broken as a five-a-sider?
Well, there's not really any windows near our pitches. I've certainly sent a few over the fence and into nowhere, I think, into the long grass. But yeah, no windows broken.
No windows. Well, okay. Well, you've just released
Yes.
a book called Embers, which is about the Albion team in 96, 97. But it's fiction, but it's using the that season as a baseline. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. So, I mean, everything, all the football is real, and each of the chapters are one of those games in the 96-97 season. So that kind of bookmarks the happenings in the character's life. So yes, set in that season.
So what inspired you to write it and use that season in particular?
I think that season was pivotal for the club in terms of it looked like they could be going out of business, could be going extinct. We were losing the Goldstone Ground, and we didn't know what was next. So I was 16 at the time, and the main character is partially based on me. So that season was always so important to me, and whenever I kind of, I guess, think back to my happiest Brighton moments, even though it was pretty bleak at a lot of those times, some of those protests and some of those moments where the fans stood up against the board, they stand out as being amazing, amazing memories. And with a couple of friends, we often talked about writing about that. And I guess fiction seemed like the way to go. Our actual memories of games from 29 years ago is pretty hazy. But I thought a novel where the main character's life is kind of mirrored by what's happening to the football club would make an interesting story. And so I started putting it together and just got in the flow with writing it. And yeah, that's where it came from.
It's
So
so
what's your...
basically, it's a love letter to back to that time, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think each of those moments that were so important, things like Fans United, when fans came from all around the country and abroad, was such an exciting moment where the football club, football clubs around the country stood up against our board and stood up for what football clubs are. That was so precious, and writing about that through a kind of novel's perspective, yeah, is expressing that love for the club and love for what we achieved at that time.
Is this your first book?
I've written a couple of others that have been children's books. So I've written books for kind of, I guess, 8, 9 year olds. But yeah, first time I've gone for football or an adult market.
Brilliant. And how did you sort of manage to discipline yourself to actually sitting down and writing all of it, or did it just kind of you start and it flowed?
I think yeah, it did flow once I got started. So I kind of wrote the first chapter, and often I've done that with projects where I've written the first chapter and then it's disappeared. So that kind of sat for a while on my computer, and then I got going into the second and third, and that from that point it just flowed. And there's a point in the story where the main character meets Steve Gripp, and at that point in my life, I had an opportunity to work for a magazine, and I interviewed Chris Eubank at the time, and I thought, well, Chris Eubank doesn't work for this story. I'm going to have Steve Gritt as this character, and I wanted that to have a ring of authenticity and truth about it. So I managed to get in touch with Steve and said, look, I'm writing this book. It's a fiction book, but could we kind of sit and do an interview as if it was 1996 and or well 97 by the time he came, and talk about it in that way? And he was so generous with his time. And so once I'd met with him again, it kind of flowed from that point. So it kind of went up to that moment of Steve Gritt arriving, and then had to pause until I got a
And
chance
did
to
it
meet him.
refresh your memory of that time as well, talking to Steve and like and then, oh yeah, I've forgotten about that bit, and give you some insight into what was happening in the dressing room as well.
Yeah, there was. I mean, there was definitely a lot of insight, where he kind of, I guess, he spoke about different players and kind of stories and things that happened behind the scenes that were, yeah, just some things that you would n never would have known. I remember him telling me about, I mean, just it seemed amazing that they did this the day before they went to Hereford. They trained on the Goldstone Ground pitch, which was ripped to pieces, and I thought that just seemed crazy that they're risking broken ankles on that pitch. So there were lots of bits and pieces that were really interesting. I mean, I think my memory was much better than Steve's memory, to be honest. He remembers it very fondly, but the match-to-match details all kind of blur into one a little bit more.
Because actually, if you're talking about a conversation between you and Steve Gritt, you're talking about obviously you as a 16-year-old fan. Who, what? Let's, before we talk about the Steve Gritt aspects of that dialogue, what were you like as a 16-year-old? I mean, were you obviously angry like the rest of us? But how many chapters are there, for instance, are written from the centre circle? Because you know, from during the middle of a match, were you an angry person who just wanted to, who didn't know where to put their rage, or did you were you very focused on your part in the in those war years? Who were you back then?
Yeah, I think it's I don't think angry was probably, I mean, there was that sort of anger that was sort of, I guess, an anger that was shared with the rest of the fans when the protest happened. But I guess it was some of the first years of going to football, and it was also, as well as being kind of, you really wanted to save the club, and of course you did, it was also really exciting. I think that there was a real thrill about it, and a real kind of creativity to what the fans did at that time. The Fans United, the whistle protest, the marches, Attila's poems outside Bill Archer's house, and all those kind of different elements. I think I found that incredibly enthralling, and exciting to be a part of, and exciting to be part of a cause that's, outside of yourself, and you're joining with other people, and you're trying to save your football club and keep something that you love and is precious to
Yeah.
you
Well,
still there.
it's a cause that you undertook that, to the extent that if you didn't, the alternatives were that the likes of us wouldn't be having this conversation because we wouldn't have a club to support. We might have a Phoenix club to support, but there was no way I was ever going to go off and support Portsmouth or Mill or something like that. So, I mean, could you feel, obviously we've all got the sort of like the spectre of history since then, but could you feel that this was something near terminal if we hadn't done it at that time?
I think it definitely felt like that. I mean, even going, there was the thought of going to Portsmouth, wasn't there, for a while, and then going to Gillingham, and maybe even leaving Brighton. I had my paper round money. There was no way I was going to be able to afford to travel to another town or city to watch Brighton. So even leaving Brighton felt like it was being kind of ripped away from me. I mean, I was desperate for him to stay, which didn't happen. I mean, there was a time where we had to be at Gillingham to continue. So even that, yeah, it felt like it was being taken away. And I think in the novel, I've tried to sort of create this character who's kind of losing their club, but losing other things in their life as well. So it's kind of mirroring the dad disappears at the same time as the club's disappearing. And so
Is it
everything
based
is kind
around a
of.
16-year-old? Yes.
Yeah, so the 16-year-old is the main character going to those games, and you follow his life. And so right at the beginning of the story, he's at 16, he's left school, but he hasn't really got any plan for what he's going to do next, and ends up just signing on at the job centre every week and not knowing what to do. There's this kind of disillusionment, and frustration. And as things get better for Brighton, things get better in his own life as well, and those things kind of coincide and go alongside each other.
Because I mean, at the beginning of the book, there's a lot of talk of like of financial hardship, of having to go and eat round at people's houses and sell some records in order to go to the game. He sold the wrong ones, by the way. Always, always, always sell the Oasis ones. They're rubbish. The other two, great. I mean, Reef. I'm all there. I'm there. I'm there for it.
There for Reef, yeah.
But
But
okay, so I mean, slightly away from the book. I mean, because I'm looking at sort of, are we talking about, volume 2, 3, 4, and so on? How do, obviously, the book will reflect your part in it, because, like I say, it's fiction based on fact. But going forward, obviously, we were protesting for about 14 years. So by the time we got to the Amex, you were 31 by this time.
yeah.
Do you have it in mind, therefore, to continue the story with all the various? Were you intimately involved at that point that you feel that there's something else that you want to say?
Yeah, I think I was much more intimately involved as a teenager than I was probably in the more, I guess the later stages of it became, I guess, increasingly political, didn't they? And less protest based, because we weren't protesting against our board anymore. We were very supportive of
We
our
were
board. And
campaigning rather than protesting, weren't we?
yeah, so whilst I was always supportive of that involved, there's probably not the same kind of narrative hooks. But I do, having written it, I do wonder, whether there's, a next chapter to tell in the
Oh,
character
yeah.
story. Obviously, I've grown 29 years older and things change,
Yeah.
and whether it will be revisited with, I
I
don't
mean,
know, our next
yeah, I mean,
magical
you.
season.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to tell the story of like Danny having to go and watch his beloved Albion playing at the same stadium as he had his school sports day.
Yes.
Well, exactly. So listen, we're getting near to the end here, but you've already kindly said that you're happy to offer the book up as a prize.
Yes.
So, another Albion Raw competition. In order to win a copy of Embers by David Atherill, we are offering a free
Yep,
signed
I'll
copy.
sign
Yep,
it.
absolutely fantastic. And it will go to the winner of our Raw competition, who
I
can
have a
correctly
question.
answer this question. In the season 1996-97, the player of the season wasn't chosen for 25 years. Eventually, when that competition was run, who won it? So who in 2022 was awarded the 1996-97 Albion Player of the Season? If you think you know the answer, send it an email to thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk. That's thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk. And we will pick the winner from on next week's show from all the winning entries. Your closing date will be Tuesday, the 22nd of April at 5 p.m. So that question again is, who in 2022 was finally chosen as the Albion's 96-97 Player of the Season? Good luck, everyone. And thank you, David, for offering that book as a prize.
It's quite all right.
Okay. So with that all in mind, was it the butler that did it? So, awful. No, all I was going to ask next is, like you say, because so when we have people, and over the past 18 years, we've had people on and people say, oh, yeah, listen to the show. I don't have the same level of punditry, or so I don't do the, you know, the stats knowledge that you do. I say, but yes, but everyone's got their story. And David here has just proven that everyone has their story and has a story to tell. So if we do go forward to 2011, do you remember, is it going to stay with you forever, the first time you walked into the Amex?
Yeah, for certain. I mean, I think the first game I went to was the first one was it was that game that Gary Hart played in and scored against
the Sussex Senior Cup final,
where he's played Eastbourne Borough,
Yeah, and that was the first one ever that was at the Amex.
The ramp up,
so,
event, wasn't it?
Yeah, being able to walk in there and see that and see Gary Hart score as well, which was very very special as well. So, yeah, an incredible journey. And yeah, you go back to 96 and think what kind of club we were, and then we became a club with this stadium, and now we've got Brazil's number nine playing for us. It's a bizarre journey that we've been on. So.
But and the point is it starts at the time of your book, and like I say, I mean you know moments in time. I mean, I think it was interesting the point that Fatboy Slim said on the show last week. AD was as the four main cultural boosts that this city got, certainly post war, was Brighton Rock, Quadrophenia, Beach Boutique 2, and then promotion to the Premier League. And here we are, you know, it's all right, the first three have got nothing to do with the Albion. But this last one, it's kind of amazing that the promotion itself is a massive step up. That I think that we all have just sort of said, yeah, well, we got promoted. But, you know, we changed on our show. We got a different listenership now, haven't we, AD? And as David said, look where we are. We've not just also had Brazil's number nine playing for us. We've had a World Cup winner. Rewind 3 years ago, you go, do what?
And that's the point that I always come back to. I mean, I still, every time I see Alexis on the telly these days, or
he's
if
one of
every
ours,
time,
isn't he? He's
I always like have a little smile because, yeah, I mean, you know, we've had players that have won the World Cup play at the Albion before, but we've never had one that was actually playing for us at the time when they listed that Golden Globe.
Yeah,
it's like you know, now that is just a pivotal moment for me, and it's like it's insane. It's just insane because when you look back to, like, you know, the crossbar being broken that game against York, against Fans United, and having to fight tooth and nail to save this club against those two horrible men. It's insane where we are now. And you know,
as Brucey said, didn't we do well?
We did do well. And that is all we have time for this week. So thank you so much to Alan Wares. Thank you to our very special guest, David Afferall. And don't forget, you can enter the competition to win his book. Quickly, the question again, Al.
Who was the Albion Player of the Season for 96-97 season, finally getting awarded that in 2022?
Answers to thealbionroar@yahoo.co.uk. But that is all we've got time for. Thanks for listening. I've been AD Packer, and this has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with Flowers Unlimited. See you again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye. Yeah.
from that muddy face, bloody hand, making we dance all night long.
Yeah, come with me.